That's today on The Daily from The New York Times.
This is Radio Catskill. WJFF Jeffersonville. Listen local.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me this evening. And, big thanks to Patricio for filling in for me last week. Thanks to everybody here at Radio Catskill for filling in for me last week. It's good to be back. Coming up on the program, we will meet the new director of the RSVP of Sullivan County AmeriCorps Seniors Program, Monica Russa. We'll also learn about fire safety because December is the month where there are the most home fires of the entire year. We've got more on that coming up. But first, New York's home care workers are suing insurance companies for systematically underpaying them for their around-the-clock work. It's a complicated story, and to find out more earlier today, I spoke with Julia Rock of New York Focus. Julia, welcome back to the local edition.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's good to be here.
So this is a bit of a complicated issue. It's multifaceted. It involves, state laws and regulations, insurance companies, unions, claims of stolen wages, claims of imminent bankruptcy, racial and class barriers at work here as well. So to get into this, I want to understand what these home care workers do and why their jobs are so tough. And you do an amazing job in the article of putting a very human face onto this by introducing us to one home care worker. Is her name Zhao?
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about her and what her work was and ultimately what happened to her?
Yes. So she's a home care worker I spoke with who worked a few days in a row each week on 24-hour shifts. So entirely around the clock. And 24-hour shifts are sort of a feature of the home care industry in New York. The workers are supposed to have at least 5 hours of uninterrupted sleep and 3 hours of meal breaks, plus a little bit more time of rest on these shifts. But in fact, she and many other workers who work on these shifts often say, you can't get 5 hours of uninterrupted sleep or, take the meal breaks required because the patients need a lot of care. So she was taking care of an elderly woman who needed, a lot of help and attention. She slept in a bed in the same room as this woman and described that often, as she was starting to fall asleep for her rest on the shift, the patient would call and need help, using the bathroom or getting water or something like that.
Right. And the quotes that you have are so direct from this worker and saying, I couldn't leave her be for 1 second, especially if she's doing something like going to the bathroom. She had to make sure this person wasn't going to fall. This is a New York State regulation about they only need to be paid for 13 hours as long as in a 24-hour shift, as long as they have at least 5 hours of sleep and at least 3 hours for a meal. But that seems like that was not the case for Zhao.
Yeah. So under what people sort of informally call the 13-hour rule, even though workers are on these 24-hour shifts, the agencies only need to pay them for 13 hours if they meet these stipulations. But of course, she described, she wasn't getting sleep at night. And in fact, a few years ago, she collapsed after one of her shifts and had to be taken to the hospital for a coronary artery bypass. And then she went back to work and a couple of years later collapsed again. And her doctor said, part of the reason she was having these health issues was because of her inability to sleep.
Wow. And you spoke with her, right? Like you had to do it through an interpreter, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I don't speak Chinese, so I interviewed her at a worker center in Manhattan through a translator.
So Zhao is now is part of this lawsuit that I introduced in the beginning, correct?
Exactly. So she and other workers who were hired by this home care agency called Great Care, you know, to go to these folks' homes and take care of them around the clock, are now suing Great Care, arguing that they, you know, because they didn't receive the proper rest and breaks on their 24-hour shifts and for other reasons, they were victims of wage theft. And so they're suing, you know, not only to get, you know, back wages and have the wage theft remedied, but also, you know, because they're advocates for an end to the system of 24-hour shifts, you know, given the impact that it had on their lives.
I'm wondering, like, how many people this is happening to. Is this happening to just a few workers, or is this really something that's happening across the board with this type of work? And then specifically, how many litigants are on this suit?
Yeah, so there's not – I haven't seen nor been able to find an exact number of how many workers work 24-hour shifts every year, but people think it's in the thousands of workers who are assigned 24-hour shifts. Something I heard is that agencies are rolling back a little bit their use of 24-hour shifts, sort of given the backlash. In terms of this lawsuit, in the class action suit, I think there are about half a dozen workers whose names and stories are outlined, although I don't know exactly how many workers were employed by the home care agency over the period the class action lawsuit covers. So I'm not sure exactly how many workers it would end up being.
And now to start talking about some of the complications with this story, there's also a difference between options that are available to some of these workers that have had this problem, whether or not they're involved with a union, if they're members of a union. Could you just explain that distinction to us quick?
Yes. Most, you know, union contracts operate with a procedure called grievance and arbitration. So instead of, you know, having members file lawsuits against companies for, you know, violating labor law or whatever, their union contracts are enforced through these out-of-court arbitration procedures. And so a bunch of workers who are members of the big union 1199 SEIU were part of a big arbitration award in 2022 that was aimed at resolving wage theft claims against, I think, just over 40 of these home care agencies. That arbitration award came under fire from some workers who said, you know, I think thousands or tens of thousands of dollars of wages were stolen to me, but because of the way this arbitration process worked, I only ended up getting a few hundred or a few thousand dollars. So, of course, you know, in the case of the class action lawsuit I was writing about against Great Care, these workers are not members of the union.
Folks that you talk to in this article say that a common refrain is, if these companies were to actually pay these people what they say they are owed, that would bankrupt the companies. Can you talk about that claim of imminent bankruptcy and how well that holds up to your research?
Totally. Well, so the short answer to this is that it's important to remember that a lot of these home care agencies are, you know, sort of small. They operate as nonprofit organizations. And a lot of their revenue comes from the insurance plans that are paying them to cover home care. And those insurance plans, which are basically sort of an extension of the state Medicaid program, they're contracted through Medicaid. They're the ones who will decide, you know, we're going to assign you a 24-hour shift worker, you know, to help this patient, but we're under the state law, we're going to assess that, you know, they can get enough rest and meal breaks that we only need to pay them for 13 hours. So basically the home care agencies say, you know, we can only pay people for 13 hours of these 24-hour shifts because that's the amount we're getting paid for, you know, to employ them on these shifts.
And yet it's the insurance companies that are stipulating the amount of work that needs to be done, like the tasks that need to be done during that time, right?
Exactly. Might say, for example, you know, this patient needs to be turned over every 2 hours, otherwise they're going to get bed sores, or this patient is going to need help, you know, using the bathroom or having meals prepared for them. So they're the ones who sort of come up with these care plans for the patients.
Mm-hmm. the people that are being that are doing this work and are claiming that they're not being compensated properly tend to be immigrants, tend to be women of color. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So nearly 9 in 10 of these home health workers in New York are women. And the statistic I've generally seen is that more than 60% of them are immigrants. And so what you'll see in a lot of these, you know, discussions of wage theft, but also sort of the broader, challenges and sometimes abuse that happens on these 24-hour shifts is that these are workers who are sort of prone in some ways to being exploited, maybe because they, you know, don't speak English as a first language or don't have as strong as what their rights are or they're not organized and things like that. So I think there are a lot of ways in which it's a workforce that's sort of been, a lot of people would say they're really taken advantage of.
Yeah, it seems like that these are people that unfortunately can easily be sidelined. And it's almost like a double whammy here because, I mean, this is a very particular type of work that I think most of us in the public aren't familiar with. Unless we got somebody in our lives that need this type of 24-hour care, it might not be front of mind. And then, unfortunately, as we've seen this happen with other stories again and again, is that people that are immigrants, people that speak another language, people of color, often also get sidelined as well as par for the course. It seems like both of those things are playing into this story.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the problems are all sort of connected. And you know, the other thing worth mentioning is that even, for the hours of work that these workers are being paid, the wages tend to be, basically at minimum wage.
Yeah, and that's the hours that they actually get paid for. That's not all the hours that they don't get paid for, which
right.
is a stipulation of New York law. So that's kind of a big question that I walk away from this from is, like up front, you're talking about this lawsuit. So this is some legal action trying to redress these wrongs. But what about any type of legislative action? Is there any interest from lawmakers to may possibly reevaluate these regulations?
Yeah, I think there's been a huge amount of legislative discussion over this for the past few years. Both the state legislature and the city council have proposed measures to end this 24-hour shift system. The other thing that I discuss a little bit in this article is there's also some building legislative momentum to scrap sort of the insurance system that was set up to pay for home care in New York. The system used to be that the state would pay for home care services sort of based on the services that were delivered. But under Governor Andrew Cuomo, the state set up this system where there were going to be sort of these private insurance plans that were going to be basically dedicated to covering home care. And these are the insurance plans that, you know, workers and advocates have said are partially responsible for, wage theft on the 24-hour shift. So there's also been some legislative momentum to sort of get rid of those plans and go back to a model where the state is just sort of paying directly for home care services.
And just to help us understand that, like, from your perspective and the reporting you've done, like, would that actually be a more direct solution rather than the current situation? If they were to actually do that, would that bring the needed help?
That's a good question. I think there are a lot of different sort of answers or to the problem of wage theft in home care. I mean, some workers have said basically the big problem is that the Department of Labor needs to be more strongly enforcing the wage laws and that they don't really enforce violations of the 24-hour rule. It does seem like there's really, growing agreement, again, among lawmakers, 1199, the union, some folks in healthcare that these insurance plans really are part of the problem of, not just wage theft, but also the sort of growing costs of the home care program. So I think there are probably a lot of different solutions being thrown around and different folks might give different explanations for it. But it seems like there's going to be momentum this legislative session to do something about home care.
Okay. And before we go, is there anything else on this issue that we didn't get to? Anything else that you want folks to know about this story?
One thing we didn't get into, but many of your listeners are probably aware of, either because they've worked in this industry or they have aging family members, is that home care is growing really quickly in New York. The state's getting, New Yorkers are getting older. There are a lot of people to be taken care of. So all of the issues that we're sort of seeing in the industry and that the state is trying to tackle are only going to, I think, become bigger issues in the year to come.
The article is Exposing Wage Theft in New York's Home Care System. We've been talking to the author, Julia Rock. The article is up now at nysfocus.com, and we'll also have it up at wjffradio.org. Julia, thanks again.
Thanks so much for having me on.
If you're just joining us, this is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. And up next, it's our check-in with Sullivan County. We're going to meet Monica Russa, who's the new director of the RSVP of Sullivan County AmeriCorps Seniors Program, a retired seniors volunteer program. Monica starts off by talking about her background.
I am a Wurtsboro native, so I'm from Sullivan County originally. I have a lot of background volunteering myself, so I know what it's like to be on the other side of that, and that's why I'm very appreciative for our volunteers here at RSVP. I am still living in Wurtsboro, which is nice. It's a nice small commute up to Monticello. I have an extensive background in human resources, actually, and I was working down in the Orange County area, so it's nice to have that commute right now.
And now working also in where you live, so it's great. So since you've been a new coordinator, what has been your experience so far stepping into this position?
It's been actually really great for me, meeting all of the volunteers and reaching out to all of our partner sites throughout the county. I'm really interested in helping with the community needs, and it's just been really great to make that connection with people.
That's great, and you're connected with the folks, and that's really what sort of the program is about. So let's talk about that. For listeners who may not be familiar with RSVP, can you explain what the program is all about and how it serves the community?
Sure. So basically what we do is we keep seniors engaged. And the way we do that is we reach out to them, see what their interests are, and then we match them up with volunteer opportunities throughout the community. The program is called Retired Senior and Volunteer Program. It's for people that are age 55 or better who are just looking for meaningful volunteer opportunities throughout our community.
But that's great that they said connecting with folks on their community. So how do you do that? First of all, when folks join the program, do you know offhand what are some of the more popular opportunities out there for RSVP members?
Yeah, sure. We have several opportunities. We do things such as people get involved volunteering for food pantries and thrift stores, libraries, our local museums. Our local hospital also has volunteers, and there's many other community-based organizations throughout Sullivan County as well. We also have people that drive for medical appointments. They drive people throughout Orange County and Ulster County, so we do have volunteers that drive for us. They also are deliverers of our very popular Meals on Wheels program, so they do take meals to people that are homebound as well.
That's great. And I know here in WJFF, we have some RSVP volunteers who come here and mm-hmm. do help work for us.
Yeah. Now, and so important to note, too, that we do have some homebound volunteers. So if you're not necessarily mobile, you can also work from home, so to speak. We have many volunteers that create cards for our veterans. If you can knit or crochet, we have many volunteers that crochet or knit hats and blankets for those who are also in need. And we also have a telephone reassurance program, which is where our seniors call other homebound seniors just to check in on them.
That's great. Like I said, it'll be contributing to society and not be hindered by the unfortunate disability you might have. Yeah, that's great. So how do you match up the skills with folks come into the program and have certain sales skills? How does that process work as matching skills with the volunteer program, with the volunteer opportunity?
Yeah, so usually our skills, there's an enrollment form, and usually what we do is we get their interests and maybe their skills, what they've done previously or what they had done for work. And then when they list all those things, we connect with them and we say, okay, these are our volunteer opportunities. Are you interested in any of these? So that's how we make that connection.
That's great. And now, and you just want to talk sort of the benefits of being a RSVP volunteer and your experience so far and what do you have in your own experience as a volunteer in your past life, the benefits of volunteering.
first and foremost, it creates social connections, right? So you don't feel so isolated. Because when you feel isolated, the depression could set in. And that's what we're trying to avoid here. We want people to be active. And also, it's meaningful. It gives purpose, right? Because you're helping out other people in the community. There are some benefits, actually, to becoming part of the program. We do offer mileage reimbursement if you travel to and from a site. And also, you're invited to special recognition events that we do throughout the year.
That's great. Again, and not only say the benefits of community, but also benefits of being recognized for your efforts. That's great. Now, how does someone who's maybe interested in joining the program join?
Oh, okay. That's interesting. All they have to do, they can reach me in my office. I can give you my phone number. You can just call 845-807-0255. My office is actually in the government center at the Office for the Aging. So if you just come into that office, you will find me there. Or you can either email me, or there's several ways to get in touch with me, and I can definitely send out some information to anyone who's interested in volunteering for our program.
Absolutely. Now, one question I forgot to ask. Is there any sort of training or support you provide for new volunteers?
So technically, they come in, we do a small orientation, and then after that, we can meet them at the partner site. And actually, the partner site is really responsible for doing all the training for whatever it is that they need out there in the community.
Okay. Just like here, we have some folks who do the production for us. We have folks who do sometimes the hosting, the All Things Considered. And I say you're absolutely right. We do provide training before they get behind the board.
Yeah, because all the sites are completely different, right? We have some thrift stores, and then we have some at Garnett Hospital might be completely different. And then we have the Federation for the Homeless, which is one of them where you're serving meals. So every site is different in their own way. So they're pretty much responsible for doing all of the training.
Right. What do you see as the future of RSVP? Do you see the program expanding in some capacity, or what do you hope to see in the future for yourself?
Oh, my goodness. That is my hope. I am being told that when COVID came in, it really wreaked havoc on our program, right? Because people, they couldn't get out. They couldn't get to their sites. Many sites were closed. So now that's reopened. I hope to build the program. I do have several ideas. I hope to add a lot more of our partner sites. So I'm working feverishly on doing that right now.
Yeah, that's a question I did have. What was the effects of COVID? Because I said that folks couldn't be with each other because of the restrictions we had. And I know things are opening up, but sometimes as other nonprofit organizations have experienced a dwindling volunteerism population, those who are aging out, moved away, or unfortunately passed away. Are the numbers back to was pre-pandemic?
They are not. Unfortunately, they are not. And part of that is a lot of when COVID hit, a lot of the stations closed down and never reopened. That's part of it. They never reopened, or they reopened, but it was so long after that, like you said, some of our volunteers aged out or unfortunately passed away. And then there weren't any new volunteers because of the fear of COVID to put in their place. Unfortunately, a lot of our partner sites, they dwindled out, and I'm reaching out and I'm trying to get them back on board with us. It's definitely been a project, but I have high hopes. I do. I see this program going into a new direction, hopefully very soon.
Right. No, definitely. Like I said, it's such a rewarding program. Just volunteering is just a rewarding endeavor to do in life. Monica, before we go, do you want to give out the number once again for folks who are interested in joining RSVP?
Absolutely. It's my direct line here at the Office for the Aging office, and my number is 845-807-0255.
Awesome. We were talking to Monica Rosa, the new RSVP coordinator for Sullivan County, talking about RSVP and the benefits for volunteering and making an impact on others. Monica, thank you so much for joining me on the program. I do really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Robayo for Radio Catskill.
Thank you, Patricio, for that report. Well, to close out the local edition tonight, we're going to talk about fires and avoiding them, because December is actually the leading month for home fires. National Fire Protection Association reported in 2022 Christmas Day and Christmas Eve ranked as the second and third highest days for home cooking fires. Of course, there's holiday decorations and Christmas trees and candles also contribute to this. Michael B. Gaffney is the Deputy Director and Fire Coordinator for Ulster County Department of Emergency Services, and he appeared on Radio Chatskill this morning to talk to Tim Bruno about tips on how to minimize the likelihood of cooking, candle, Christmas tree, and decoration fires.
There's several factors. For people that still have live Christmas trees, we got to make sure that they keep them well watered, as well as large family gatherings, cooking things in the oven, and just your attention gets pulled in so many different ways, right? And we have kitchen fires and oven fires, those types of things.
Yeah, I want to talk about that in terms of cooking fires, but first, relating to holiday decorations, lights, candles, how do they contribute to that spike in fire during the holidays?
You want to make sure that your light bulbs on the strands of lights don't get too hot, because when they get hot, and the tree dries out, that creates enough energy to start a fire. So we want to keep the trees well watered and hydrated. And if you notice your light bulbs that they get too hot, you want to get those changed out for newer style light bulbs.
Yeah, you mentioned watering the tree. Christmas tree fires are actually kind of rare, but they tend to be more serious when they occur, right?
Correct. A lot of times people aren't home, and so they go undetected, which leads to a larger catastrophe.
And we mentioned fire hazards when cooking. What are some of the things that folks need to be aware of when you're preparing meals and cooking during the holiday season?
Definitely want to be cautious of the vessel you're using. If it's a frying pan or if you're deep frying a turkey, for example, you want to make sure you read all the directions and then the proper use of the equipment before you do it. Make sure that the turkey is dry, because it'll spatter the oil, which then creates a fire hazard.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we think of holiday season, you're kind of associating it with the tree or the lights or packaging. But as I mentioned in the introduction, the holiday is the second and third highest days for home cooking fires are Christmas Day and Christmas Eve. So folks really need to stay safe in the kitchen.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about some of the other things that are causing these kinds of fires. Lithium-ion batteries and electronic devices, what role do they play in these fire risks?
So they, as you've probably seen in the news, they are a really big issue in New York City and surrounding metro areas. So far up here, we haven't noticed a big issue with them, although we have had a couple. A lot of times what happens is people order batteries that are not either UL certified or third party certified, and they either arrive damaged or they become damaged over time over multiple charging scenarios. And once a battery becomes damaged, it should be disposed of. Otherwise, it could lead to a fire.
So you should look for that UL symbol when you're purchasing any devices that contain lithium-ion batteries?
UL for sure, or any other third-party certification testing, yes.
And what's the proper way to handle a damaged lithium-ion battery and recycle it?
So you'd have to contact the local either recycling agency that specifies with hazardous waste, or I know some of the big box stores like the Lowe's and the Home Depot's do offer those recycling bins. Typically, when you first walk in the doors, they're right near the vestibule. They'll take them back as well.
And, just some other just common mistakes people should avoid or just be aware of for prevention and safety during the holiday seasons that you want to share.
Yeah, just be careful when you're outside. If you're snow blowing or doing any kind of maintenance outside, often we'll have injuries or accidents happen with snow blowers. People setting up their Christmas decorations, slips and falls off of ladders or rooftops. Those types of things, we want to use extra caution always.
We're talking to Michael B. Gaffney. He's the Deputy Director and Fire Coordinator for the Ulster County Department of Emergency Services. You can tell we're talking to him right there in the office of Emergency Services. We'll let you get back to your good work. And thank you so much for joining us and reminding folks about how to stay safe during this holiday season with home fires.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim Bruno, for that report. And remember, catch Tim Bruno every weekday morning at 10 on Radio Chatskill. Thank you so much for being here with me. My name's Jason Dole. I'll be back again tomorrow night. Do stay with us. Coming up next, we've got The Daily. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from NACL Theater Highland Lake, celebrating 20 years of innovative performance and community action. NACL.org. And from listener donations at WJFFradio.org.